Today we are going to discuss the, to start at least the discussion of the renormalization as viewed from the point of view of Ken Wilson. So Ken Wilson, in fact, after several years of thought about thinking about the relation between quantum field theory and statistical mechanics, and in particular the problem of understanding the critical phenomena, came out with a very general and very powerful new point of view that I'm going to discuss here as you from the point of view of a quantum field theorist. But you already got some idea on what it is and how it can be used for statistical mechanical problems. Okay. So, but before that, let us go back a little bit to perturbative renormalization. Normalization for the 5-4 theory in D equal 4, but in the massive case, because in fact that's important to when we are going to discuss the Wilson point of view that makes no difference between the different couplings. Okay. So we have seen that in order to define a renormalized ultraviolet finite quantum field theory in 5-4, what you have to use is to perform a functional integral. I'm still staying with my favorite functional quantization procedure that is functional integral, but you can do that also in canonical quantization with an action which is of the form exponential of minus some renormalized action. And the renormalized action is of the form of the what you expect for plus 5-4 of the form you would have expected from the classical theory, but with renormalized parameters that were denoted here A, B, and C. And they have to be fine-tuned or adjusted as a function of the physics you want to enforce or to observe. You want to compute something that's going on at a given renormalization scale. So at a given renormalization scale, mu, you want to express the properties of the Venon in terms of a renormalized coupling. So let us call this a renormalized coupling GR. But this functional integral is defined in terms of a theory with an ultraviolet cutoff or regulator, lambda, that is much, much larger than mu. This is a mass or an energy or a momentum scale. Okay. And so A, B, and C have to be, are different from the renormalized coupling that is related to the physical quantity you measure or you compute in your theory. And we have seen that in order to make the theory consistent and massless, well, B has to be fixed. It's mass, the mass coupling, the mass parameter, the phi squared coupling is fixed by the fact that the theory is massless. A can be kept to zero, and G has, depends on GR, mu, and lambda in a very particular way. Okay. But that's the general form of the renormalized action that will have to be kept when you do perturbation at higher orders than one loop order. So it's in fact, renormalization works at all orders. So first, now what's happening if you, we want to have a theory that is massive. Okay. So remember, we got A equal 1. We got C equal G renormalized plus G renormalized squared 3/2 1/4 pi squared logarithm of lambda squared divided by mu squared. And so this was up to term of order gr squared, up to term of order gr cube, the next order. And we had that, we had to adjust the coefficient b so that it was equal to minus gr, 1/2, and 1 over 4 pi squared lambda squared, plus term of order gr squared. Yes. Okay, so this was, so the phi cube, phi squared coupling was zero at tree level, that's the classical theory, but you have to adjust it so that the physical mass is equal to zero. If you make this calculation, you find that the physical mass is zero. Okay, so it's zero at classical order, and it stays zero at second order. Okay. So now, if you want to have a theory that has a physical mass that is different from zero, of course, what you have to do is to change B. So you can do that. Let me give just the results at the calculation. Let me introduce a renormalized mass that I call MR, which will be different from zero. Now, and choose as a parameter here, I change B, of course, by a parameter MR squared at classical order, so that for a classical theory, MR, the renormalized mass, is the physical mass of the theory, of the classical theory. But then, remember, you had this diagram here that I drew here. This diagram contained a divergence like log squared, and it contains a divergence like lambda squared, the mass squared. So there is an additional divergence that is present if the mass of the series is non-zero. So there is another counter term that you have to add here. Well, do the calculation, and you find that this counter term is minus mr squared over 4 pi squared log of lambda squared over mu squared. Okay, so this is new terms. The new term that we have introduced for the massive theory are the bare mass and this new mass counter terms. Okay? And taking as an ansatz, but it works. The two-point function is still finite. Okay. And if you compute the physical mass, so the two-point function gamma renormalized of P is still of the form P squared plus M physical squared plus term of order GR cube. So and if you compute the physical mass, you found, of course, that the physical mass will be MR related to this renormalized mass parameter at first order. But then you do calculation. I just give the results. It's a little bit. There is a correction proportional to GR. There is an MR squared over 2, a 1 over 4 pi squared, and a logarithm of MR squared divided by mu squared. Okay, that's the result of the calculation. Exercise. Compute the physical mass. Okay, so you see the physical mass now is finite. It doesn't depend on lambda anymore, but it depends on the ratio of MR and mu. So it depends also on the renormalization scale. You see also that this renormalized mass is not the physical mass. So you say, okay, why didn't I choose as parameter MR equal mu squared in this case? Then the physical mass would have been equal to the renormalized mass. That makes calculation much simpler. That's what is done in QED. But in fact, in general, if you have a theory like the standard model or QCD, where you have particles with masses like quarks, but you have different families of quarks with different masses, or even in a family, you have the two up and down quarks have different masses, then, well, you have a liberty to choose what is the renormalization scales. So it's better to take as a renormalization scale that defines renormalized mass parameters the same renormalization scale that the renormalization scale of the coupling constant, for the coupling constant. And in that case, you see, the renormalized mass is a parameter of the theory, like the renormalized coupling, and the physical parameter, the scattering amplitudes, the mass of the particle of the theory, the mass in the spectrum of the theory, depend on GR, on those renormalized parameters, and mu. Okay. Good. So now I'm going to show briefly to you that you can associate to this renormalized mass a beta function. So it's a new parameter. And of course, the physics will depend, since the physics of depend on mu, you may ask, in this renormalization scheme, how does the renormalized mass depends on mu if the physics is not, if the physics is the same? So for a given physical theory, if we change the renormalization scales, that tells you how to compute or how to measure the renormalized coupling and the renormalized mass parameter, how do they change? Okay. So let's do that. Let us define a renormalization beta function for the mass parameter MR. Okay. Remember, for the coupling constant, the beta function was simply defined as beta of G renormalized is how G renormalized has to change as a function of mu is the if basically the physics is unchanged. So basically, A, C, and B are unchanged. So okay. And we found that this beta function was 1/2 3 over 4 pi squared GR squared. So we expect to have exactly the same definition for MR. But there is a difference. GR is dimensionless. MR has a dimension. It has a dimension 1 in units of momenta. So it's better work with a dimensionless parameter. And if I want to express the renormalized mass parameter in terms as a dimensionless, I have to divide it by some unit of mass. The only unit of mass I have, of course, in my calculation, in my definition of the model, is the renormalization scale. So let me define the parameter T renormalized as simply M renormalized squared divided by mu squared. So it's a dimensionless mass parameter. I take MR squared because that's the coefficient that appears here instead of M, but that's not a big. Okay. And now let's do the same calculation that we did for that. Well, here it's. How is it working? Yes. So I want to have, this is, I'm sorry. There is a subtlety. Okay. This was real. Okay. So the idea here is that I make a renormalization, change of renormalization scale. I change GR according to what I've computed before, yes?
When we defined the coupling constant renormalized, it was the four-point function at a reference momentum, right?
Yes.
Gamma of the four moment.
Yes.
You are introducing this MR
yes.
as a parameter, but it is
yes.
also defined in a similar way.
Ah, that's a good point. Very good point. Here, the renormalized coupling is defined with reference to the four-point function for the massless theory. And then I make a mass perturbation. I have a mass that is zero, and then I switch on the mass, if you want. But I don't change the definition of GR. I could do that. It would make calculation more complicated. But that's perfectly possible. But the simplest way to do the calculation is to do the calculation for the massless theory. So that's defined a parameter. And of course, then the scattering amplitudes, for instance, for the two particles going into two particles, that defines an effective coupling constant, will depend both on GR and on MR. You are perfectly right. Yes. But let's keep that. Okay. So then, of course, you can define, so you do simply, the physics change means that look at how you must change MR as a function of mu so that the physical mass doesn't change. So, the idea is how should I change mu TR as a function of mu when the physical coupling constant doesn't change and the physical mass does not change. Okay, so do the calculation. What you find is that this defines a new beta function that will be associated to the parameter t. And it will depend both on GR and TR. So take this as a definition of the beta function associated to t. And the previous beta function here was a beta function associated to the coupling constant. Well, do the calculation, and if I am not mistaken, what you find is that this is proportional to TR itself, and there is a factor minus 2 plus GR 1/2 1 over 4 pi squared. Okay. So you see, this TR comes from the fact that the renormalized mass has a dimension of mu. So if you want to change mu, you have to change MR according to mu, so that, for instance, TR, well, rather, you know, at first order, at leading order, the physical mass is proportional to MR. So if you change mu, you must change TR accordingly. So this gives a factor minus 2. You see, so this is, if you want, associated to the canonical dimension of MR squared, which is equal to 2. But this comes from the log of mu here. You see? So it's a renormalization effect. It comes from this log that comes from this log that comes from this one loop diagram. Okay? Good. So you can define a beta function for this dimensionless parameter TR exactly in the same way as you can define a beta function for the coupling constant. So we are going to use this result when we are compare this calculation done in perturbation theory with the calculation we shall be able to do using Wilsonian renormalization. Okay. So keep these two formula, this one. and this one for the beta function, oops, in mind. Okay? Yes? Yes.
Why are you just keeping the linear order in A or the series order in A?
For?
For A, the first constant.
Well, A doesn't change. A is 1 to order gr squared.
Right, but to be consistent with the other ones, shouldn't you also consider A up to order g squared?
No, because you see, what we are doing is that we are going one order beyond the classical calculation. So you are going to first order in perturbation theory. So at classical order, A is 1, C is GR, B is MR. We are going one order beyond, so GR, GR squared, GR. If you prefer, go and put again the H bar factor, remembering that you are doing doing a perturbative calculation is doing, in fact, a semi-classical expansion where you keep the term of order h bar. So these are the classical terms that are order 1. These are the, these are the terms that are order h bar. And these are the terms which will be of order h bar squared. But to keep the order in terms of h bar, you simply have to count the loops in the diagram. So this is a diagram of order h bar, and the other diagram that gives this coefficient is also a diagram of order h bar. Okay? Good. So another remark I just want to do in 2 minutes. We did the calculation in D equal 4. In D equal 4, in fact, it turns out that the coefficients that have to be renormalized are the original coefficient of the classical Lagrangian, d phi squared, phi squared, phi to the 4. You see? So you have to introduce d phi squared in general, phi squared and phi 4. Counter terms. Well, we showed it by calculating it explicitly in one loop. Now there is a general theory of renormalization in perturbation theory that states that this is true to all order. I won't have time to discuss it, but that's more advanced mathematical physics, basically. But this was performed in the 50s and the 60s, and it works. So one says that the theory is renormalizable because you start from a classical theory and modifying a little bit the term in the action or in the Hamiltonian, you get an ultraviolet consistent theory in perturbation theory. Now, you can do the same calculation in less than 4 dimensions, 2 dimensions, 3 dimensions, or 4 minus epsilon expansion using dimensional regularization. Then what you found is that only a mass counter term is needed because this diagram is divergent. See? And in addition, in fact, only a finite number of diagrams are divergent. For instance, in 2 dimensions, only this diagram is divergent. In D equals 3 dimensions, only this diagram and this diagram are divergent. So the situation is much simpler. The theory is said to be super, super renormalizable because it is very easy to renormalize it. In some sense, you don't have to be super to renormalize it. Now, in D equal larger than 4, for instance, if you are in 6 dimensions, then the situation is very bad. Because in D equal 6, this diagram is divergent. this diagram is divergent, but this diagram is also ultraviolet divergent, which means that you have to introduce at one loop a phi 6 counterterm. So you need to introduce the same plus phi 6. And in fact, it turns out that you have also to introduce something like d phi squared plus Laplacian of phi squared, etc. And then at higher orders, you need phi 8, etc. So if you want to try to define a renormalized theory, you have to modify completely the original theory. And in fact, you cannot do that in a really consistent way, and things get out of control. You know, at each order in perturbation theory, you need to introduce a new renormalized parameter, new renormalized coupling. So the situation is not under control. And the theory is said to be non-renormalizable. Okay. And we shall discuss also a bit later or tomorrow what it means to be for a theory to be renormalized or non-renormalizable in the Wilsonian framework. Okay, but keep in mind this denomination if you haven't met it already. Okay. Okay. Good. So now, if you have no question, I'm going to look at this quantization of the phi 4 theory from a different point of view, that is, a point of view of treating it as a statistical mechanical system and using the approach of Ken Wilson. So let me go to a different board. So, what is this? The idea is, in fact, well, to consider the theory in the same theory, but from a different point of view. Well, here I have written an energy or momentum scale. And somewhere on this energy scale, there is a renormalization scale. Which is basically the energy scales at which we are making our calculation or making our experiments and extracting out of them what are the couplings of the theory, what are the properties of the theory. So that's the theory where the lab scale, where we work. And somewhere here, we had a regulator that was used to define the theory and to take the continuum limit. Okay. And what we did was that we start from this. So we keep mu fixed. And we are looking at what's happening if we try to get rid of the regulator to obtain a COE that doesn't depend on the detail of the regularization. Okay, and we are trying to see, is it possible? So in some sense, it means that if you start from some regulator, how do we add degrees of freedom to the theory? If we have degrees of freedom to the theory by making the ultraviolet regulator larger, how do we change the parameter in the original action in the functional integral or in the original Hamiltonian in the canonical formism in order to still get the same or almost the same theory at the renormalization scale. Okay? So in our perturbative scheme, we add degrees of freedom. And we see how is it possible to change the parameter in the original action of the theory so that we still keep the physics at scale mu under control and get a consistent quantum field theory. Okay. So that's what we are doing in perturbation theory. Now, from the point of view of Wilson in statistical physics, that's the opposite. We have a system that is defined at some microscopic regulator and we remove degrees of freedom to see how the effective theory changes. Yes? Well, that's simply because if you change, if you remember in our formalism, we have defined, for instance, we have defined by saying that phi of k was well defined if k was smaller than lambda prime. So if we enlarge this to a lambda larger than lambda prime, we are adding k between lambda and lambda prime. So in the functional integral, we are adding modes and integrating over them. Okay. I'm going to do that explicitly a bit later. So you'll see. Okay. So the idea of Wilson is to start from the theory at fixed cutoff lambda, the macroscopic, the high energy cutoff, with a given action at that, which would be called the bare action, and integrate out the momenta, for instance, between lambda and some lambda prime, to get what is called a renormalized or effective action. Okay. So let me first just re-explain to you what is the idea on at a very formal level. And then we are going to do a calculation with a one loop approximation to compare this approach with a perturbative approach. So let us start from, the simplest way to view that is to view this on a lattice. So let me define the theory on a lattice. And so I have a lattice with a cutoff A, which will play the role of 1 over lambda. So this is a minimal distance. Okay. And so space-time is discrete. I go back to the old idea of Heisenberg and to an idea that was developed, well, in particular by Ken Wilson for gauge theories. And I defined a functional integral with this cutoff A. So I compute something which is exponential of minus. So I'm still in the Euclidean setting since I want to compare with the approach in statistical mechanics. Yes?
I think when you say that you integrate over the high momenta,
yes?
You're chopping off degrees of freedom of your theory.
Yes.
Right? But then that describes another theory, right?
I'm going to, that's what I'm going to describe. Okay. And then I have an action. Oh, and in my notes, I'm using for action now an A. So A is called the action. The action is called A of phi instead of S of phi. One reason being that I will be using renormalization scaling factors S. So I will have scaling factors that are denoted S, and two S's is too much for the consistency of the notation. So I start from a theory that is defined by an action A of phi, and this action A of phi for our model can be precisely something like, well, a discretization, so something like the sum. So it will be the discretization of the integral dx of 1/2 d phi squared plus some parameter. Well, let me call it t. T over 2 phi squared plus g over factorial 4 phi 4. But then I may have other terms. I will have an h over 6 phi 6. I may have some coefficient, I don't know, something times nabla phi squared, etc. So let me consider that I have this, the usual terms. Of my theory, and I had those, what is called non-renormalizable double couplings. Okay? And that's consistent because the theory is discretized. So I have no momenta higher than 1 over A, or no distances smaller than A, so no ultraviolet divergences. And of course, when discretizing means that the sum over x has to be replaced by the sum over the sides of the lattice times the factor a to the power of the dimension of spacetime times phi of I, let us say. If at the site I, I have phi I, well, the derivative has to be replaced by finite difference, like phi I plus phi of, well, phi I plus 1 minus phi I divided by A, or things like that, etc. So you replace integrals by sum, you replace derivatives by finite difference. Etc. And I won't make things precise. Okay? So now the idea of, well, let me go back to this old. You see. The idea of how to start from a theory that is defined at this scale and to go down in scale is to perform a block spin transformation, which would be a renormalization transformation. So the idea of using block spins as goes back to Leo Kadanoff in the 60s, but its full power was in fact developed mainly by Ken Wilson, or what other great physicists were involved in that. So the idea is you start from this lattice, see? That has a small cut of A. Then you consider a larger lattice. Well, let me keep yellow. You consider a lattice made out of blocks. For instance, here I'm making blocks of 3 by 3, if I am not mistaken, something like that. Okay. So you average of a block of size B times A, where B is some number. So here, B equals 3, but that's just a choice. Okay? And so here the variables are phi of I, with I belongings to a lattice z to the power d. That's the value of the field at the site I. Okay. Now, if I have a block B, let me denote the blocks by B. B belongs to a larger lattice. So here is the lattice of the Bs. Let's see. This is a B. So this was originally an I. At a given point I have a phi I. Then let me define the average, a block field variable as simply phi, with my notation, I will denote it phi tilde of B, as the average of the phi into the block. So in this case, this will be simply the sum for all the i's in the block B. You see my notation, I is the site of the original lattice. B is a block, therefore B is the site of this new lattice, original lattice. So I take the sum of the phi I, so I make just a linear average. And of course, since I'm taking the average, I divide by B to the power minus the dimension of space. Okay? So that's the average. Good. And I start from this original functional integral, which was something like the integral of over I for all the I's apart belonging to the lattice. So let me call this lattice lambda. Okay. Lambda denotes just the lattice. Okay. So I wanted to compute this big integral and associated integrals. So this is the measure. And let me rewrite this in terms of the phi tilde. So I can just do something like that. I can rewrite this as an integral over the B belonging to the new lattice lambda tilde, d phi tilde of B, then the delta of this object, phi tilde of b minus d, sum over I, belonging to a block of phi I. Okay, so now let me assume that Of course, I can rewrite this as an integral of the form d phi tilde of b, products for b in the lattice tilde of exponential some effective action of phi tilde of b, where e minus a effective of phi tilde of b is just these integrals where I don't integrate yet over the phi tilde. So this is just integral over all the phi I but with a constraint that on each block the average is fixed. So I enforce that on each block the average is phi tilde b times e minus a of phi b. So that's something that makes sense. Here I get an effective action for the block phi tilde of b. I don't explain how to compute it. In general, it's difficult, but in some special case or with some nice, well chosen approximation, you can compute this. You get an effective action. So this is the first step, step one. Now, the step, so this was okay, step one. Now, step two, I want to compare this effective action for the block variables to the original action. Step two. Compare A of phi I with A effective of phi tilde for the block variables. Well, then there is a bit of a subtle point. This new lattice is not the original lattice. Of course, it has a larger mesh. So in order to do this comparison, we must perform a rescaling. So we start from this lattice with a mesh A tilde equal B times A. And we shrink it by a factor b. So that we get, so this was a lattice lambda tilde. We get a lattice that I'll call lambda prime with a mesh A prime equal A. Then I can compare things. So in order to do that, of course, while this seems quite trivial, well, this amounts in to perform a rescaling on space. Okay. Now there is a little subtlety. In order to do that, you must perform a rescaling both in space and on the field phi tilde. Why is it so? That's because if I want to compare the effective action to the original action, I would like that the terms are not too different. So, for instance, I would like that the effective action contains a term with a gradient of phi that is not much different from the one of the original action. Okay, for instance, if the original action had a term like 1/2 of d phi squared, the effective action that I will get at the end has also a term like phi squared with the coefficient of the same order. Yes?
One little thing. You're writing there the partition function.
Yes?
In the last line, the second term shouldn't have the measure of the d phi I suppose?
Yes, of course. That's here. This is a measure for the d phi tilde b, and this, yes. So here I have, if you want, if I have a box of size L, I'll have n, I have n equal L divided by A d variables of integration. Here I have only A tilde. I have only, I'm sorry, not A, n, let's say, n. Here I have a number n tilde of order L over BA to the power d equal n divided by b to the power d variable. So I have indeed less degrees of freedom.
What I mean is that this second term that you have here, when you introduce the delta function,
yes,
introducing the constraint, but
yes,
you still have to integrate over the d phi I.
But that's what I'm doing here.
Oh, yes.
I'm sorry. Yes, no, this was so implicit for me. And yes, I'm very sorry. Yes, no. This will be equal to this one. And if you integrate over the phi I, you get this with this definition. Yes, no, it was so automatic for me that I forgot to write it. Okay. So if you do this, you have to perform a rescaling of the phi. So I have this new lattice I. I will denote a site by I prime. It's the same lattice, but here, this is a rescale lattice. So don't forget that it is the rescale lattice by phi prime. And I perform a rescaling by a factor B. So I said that if I have a site, if I have a site, a block, so a block B corresponds to a site I prime of the rescale lattice, and I just defined a rescaled field phi prime on the rescaled lattice lambda prime by, of course, phi prime of I equal phi tilde of B, my original field average over a block B, but with some factor B delta. So delta is some rescaling dimension. To be adjusted or chosen properly in the calculation. And will turn out to be important. Okay? And once you have done that, of course, let me define the renormalized action. A prime of phi prime are simply, well, the effective action for phi tilde. So this is just a change of variable. But with this change of variables, you see that this original action becomes an integral product for I prime belonging to the rescaled lattice lambda prime. D phi prime of II times exponential of minus the renormalized action A prime of phi prime. You see? Yes?
You're rescaling the field such that the term of the secondary derivative stays the same.
Yeah, that's one recipe. Well, you have to choose that. But basically, you have to choose that so that the action doesn't, you know, phi prime is just, you make a redefinition of the field that makes the action of the same form on the other one.
I'm thinking in the context of statistical mechanics when there's an anomalous scaling dimension.
Yes.
Here,
yes.
Here, it's like setting that anomalous dimension.
Yes. No, because in fact, what it turns out that if you do the calculation consistently, delta will be this anomalous scaling dimension of the field, or just to say, the scaling dimension of the field. You will see that in an example soon. But basically, you see, for instance, imagine that phi at the original phi can take the value plus or minus one, because it is the Ising model. So instead of trying to quantize field theory, I'm trying just to quantize the Ising model. You see? So phi I, of course, at a given point, phi I can take the value minus one or plus one. Okay? So this is for phi. Once you make the block spin average, you are computing an average of plus and minus sign on a block. So you get something which can take a value, of course, like that. It has some distribution, typical distribution. And in general, the typical distribution for phi tilde, the width, is much less than one. Simply because if you take assume that at high temperature, phi I are plus or minus one are independent, then the sum on the average is something with a variance of the order b to the power minus d over 2 by the. Okay. So it's smaller. So here is one. This is much smaller than one. So the idea of this rescaling is to go to a phi prime simply by rescaling the phi so that now it has a width of order one. So that's what a field rescaling, so adjusting the scaling dimension of the field means. So this is just a strategy. I'm not doing any calculation. Okay. Okay, so by doing that, you see that the original action was equal to this original integral sum or integral is equal to this one. But now with a different coefficients. So you have made a transformation. In the space of actions A of phi. You see? I have a big space. I have a big space of actions. And here is the original action A. I move to the action A prime. Okay? By a rescaling by a factor B. Okay. And now let us start to be just a bit more qualitative, you know. The original action, I've wrote it like that. So in general, you can write such an action as something like a sum or an integral, if you want, if you take into account the correlations of the dimension, you can write it as something like an integral of a sum of operator O alpha or phi times some couplings kappa alpha. So the O alpha of phi are local operators. By local operators, I mean functions of phi, the derivative of phi, the second derivative of phi, etc., at a given point of the lattice. So, for instance, this is an operator. This phi squared is an operator. This is an operator that involves just the derivative of phi or the finite difference of phi. This is an operator that involves two derivatives, but you might very well have an operator like phi squared times the product of the derivative of phi. So it's an operator that involves both phi and above phi. So sum of local operators at a given point, you know, with the discretization, discretized properly. Okay? And the kappa alpha are just the couplings, if you want, couplings or parameters of the action. So to different values of those parameters correspond different actions, different models, different functional integrals with a regulator. Okay? So performing such a rescaling means changing the kappa alpha. If you want, you have an abstract space of theories or of actions, and kappa 1, kappa 2, etc., are the coordinates in this space. And so, performing these rescalings amounts to start from some sets of kappa alpha and performing a B rescaling or a B block transformation, you get some kappa alpha prime. That's the general idea of Wilson normalization group. And now, the idea of Wilson is perform that again. So here you get prime, double prime. So perform this, let us call it n times, so that you get a rescaling by a factor S equal B to the power N. So at the end, in fact, you get a theory A that will depend A of S. So now I have performed a global rescaling by a factor S. Okay? Yes?
Local operators.
Yes.
What justifies thinking that after this renormalization group analysis, this action has exactly the same functional form, so that I can compare the different functions?
Well, that's the point. In fact, if you start from an action that has only those original terms, you generate all those terms and, in fact, an infinite number of terms by one operation. So if those were the original, these are new ones. So in fact, this whole analysis, if you want to define it rigorously, has to be performed in an infinite dimensional space of a series that depends on an infinite number of couplings. Okay. So that's a difficult things to do. In fact, mathematicians got crazy about that. And only in some very, very, very special case, you can do that exactly for some very special theories. This has been done by some mathematical physicists and some mathematicians, but it's difficult. The point is that in general idea, say, for a physicist at least, this will make sense if you can truncate that to a large enough space of theory with a finite number of couplings, so work in a finite dimensional space of actions, make approximation on this scheme, so yes, you stay in this space, and get results which are close to the physics. But this requires doing approximation. So the general mathematical definition of a renormalization group flow in the space of couplings is something very, very difficult to do, except in some very special case. And well, either just now or a bit later, I'm going to show you, or tomorrow, I'm going to show you an approximation schemes that gives nice and sensible physical results. But it is an approximation. Okay. This question you ask is general for statistical mechanics. It's not a special question if we are interested into the application of this Wilsonian approach to randomize to quantum field theory. Okay. Okay, so if you get this by a rescaling factor S, at the end you get some effective couplings, kappa, alpha, depending on S. You see? Depends on S. Okay.
So by rescaling, you don't mean by the rescaling of the entire action, just with the blocks.
Yes, you perform. Then you perform blocks on the blocks and blocks on the blocks of the block, etc. Okay. And now you have to think a little bit about what the block field variables become. Remember, we start, so this is a transformation on the couplings. Okay. So this is a transformation for the couplings. Now we have to think a little bit over what's the result of this transformation for the fields variable. Remember, from this, the phi prime is defined as B delta phi tilde, where phi tilde was the average. So in some sense, it's just an average of the original field variables. So on the field variables, we start from a field phi. By the rescaling, we get a phi prime equal B to the power delta phi, where delta has been adjusted, is something that depends. Then if you perform a new rescaling, so here this is, you get the kappa double prime alpha. Here you get a phi double prime, that it will be B delta prime times B delta of phi. So this is the delta you had chosen at step one. This is the delta you had chosen at step two. And in fact, in general, this delta doesn't need to be the same. Because if for some couplings you get something like that, you can very well get something for another coupling, something different. So in general, the rescaling factor depends on the points where you are. you start from here, it's better to apply your scaling factor delta, then you apply your scaling factor delta prime, etc. Okay. So at the end of this transformation, what you get is a phi of S that depends on S, which is given. So this is the original field. This is the rescaled field. This is the rescaled field. So at the end, you get phi S equal some factor Z times the original field. And this factor depends on S. And of course, this factor is just the product of the Bs. You see? So you have a rescaling of the field. Okay. Okay, so this is a very general picture of what you are doing when you are doing this. Now, of course, this is very abstract, very formal, and you may ask, what is it useful for? I just have re-expressed a functional integral over field variables with some action, or a statistical mechanics of a summing of a configuration with some Hamiltonian, into another one with less degrees of freedom, but more couplings. So it's useful because it has consequences for the correlation functions. Okay. Imagine that you start to compute correlation function on the original lattice. That at two points, x1 and x2, that are far away. So I am computing the expectation value of the product of phi1 and phi of x2 with the original action A. And this is, as usual, defined as integral the product over the I belonging to A of exponential minus A of phi of x1, phi of x2, divided by phi. Now, perform the Bloch-Sphene transformation once. You expect that this won't be too different from phi tilde of x1, phi tilde of x2, computed with the effective action A effective. Because, this will be true if, of course, the distance between x1 and x2 is much larger than the size of the block. Because considering the value of the field here or in a point nearby shouldn't change much when compared to this one. So I expect that this is true if x1 minus x2 is much larger than p times a. OK? Therefore, this is, remember that we did a rescaling. So this, therefore, this should be the same thing that phi prime of x1, phi prime of x2. Computed with the renormalized action A prime, except that by going from the lattices of the block to the rescale lattice, we have changed the dimension. We have shrink space. So this is x1 divided by s. This is x2 divided by s. And also, we have rescaled the field. So we have a factor b to the power minus 2 delta. If we re-expressed phi tilde in terms of phi prime, you see. And go on. You expect that this will be not much different from the correlation function of the rescaled field phi s computed, I'm sorry, this is x divided by b, and x divided by b. Because I've just made a rescaling by a factor of b. But if you continue, you get phi s of x1 rescaled by the factor s, phi s of x2 rescaled by a factor s, with, in front of this, this factor, z of s to the power minus 2. You see? So, the original action correlation function for the original model with an action A should be related to the final, the correlation function rescaled by a factor S, of course, computed with the action A of S. So depending of the couplings, rescale couplings. So now, let us rewrite this as a correlation function. So let me rewrite this as a correlation function, let us call it g of x1, x2, depending of the original couplings kappa alpha. I have an infinite number of couplings, but or a large number of couplings, kappa alpha, kappa 1, kappa 2, kappa 3, etc. This should be not too different from g of x1 divided by s, x2 divided by s, the renormalized coupling kappa alpha of s, times this factor z of s to the power minus n. You see? So this starts to look very much like what we got yesterday. Yes?
One thing, when you do this approximation, the correlation function for large distances is like this. You're far away from the critical point. You're assuming, I mean, that the correlation length is fine.
No. In fact, this approximation is valid. This approximation is in fact valid as long as the effective action AS has only short range interactions. Imagine so. See, if the original action is something like that with some of those coefficients bigger. But at the end, you have no big terms with a lot and not a lot of derivatives. Then, in practice, if you compute the action for a field configuration here, and at some point you change one of the spin, or one of the value of the phi far away, if the original action doesn't change too much, one says that this action A of S has short range interaction. You see?
However, there are choices of parameters where the correlation length diverges, right?
Yes.
Critical point.
No, here I have no, I've made no approximation, no assumption on the correlation length. Then we are going to use that for a theory when it is close to a critical point. But that's very general. But for the moment, this is a scenario. So you have seen, I think that you have seen this scenario in the statistical mechanics lecture. And you have made some calculation using this scenario. I'm going to make another calculation, but yes?
Perhaps it goes with
yes?
Andre's question for masses field, that works as well.
Yes. In fact, there is a nice exercise that consists in taking a Gaussian field on a lattice and performing this kind of renormalization group transformation. That's a specific case where you can perform exactly the calculation because you have a big Gaussian integration. And so if you enforce a constraint on the sum of the fields and integrate over the field with this constraint, it's still a Gaussian integral. So you can still compute. So in this case, you can compute the effective, the renormalized action and perhaps plus, well, I won't have time to start to do the calculation for 5.4. So let me just present. What is this? This is. Let me just present. Yes. Oh, I am sorry. N was for, I'm sorry, I'm very sorry. This is, of course, minus 2. It's the same. No, I'm sorry. I was just generalize that for a series with n point function. Yes, yes, I'm sorry. Okay. So let me, no, I made a mistake. This is not what I wanted to have. Yes. Let us consider a free field theory. An action with your original action is something like that. Okay. So on the lattice, this is simply sum over the lattice, a to the power d minus 2, phi I plus E1 mu minus phi of I squared sum in all dimensions. So we have a lattice like that. This is a unit vector in direction mu. So this is this. So this is a, well, the performing the integral over the field is just a Gaussian integral. So you can perform that. You can compute A prime very easily. A prime of phi prime will still be a Gaussian integral. So it will be something of the form. It will involve, it will still involve some phi, combination of phis. Simply now, it will involve pair of, so at the beginning, we start with an action which just next neighbor interactions. After a normalization, you get an effective action with long range interaction. You see? Well, the factor A are not important, so let us just say that at A equal 1, this is a unit lattice. Then you get some k of I and g with some renormalized kernel. You get some kernel. Well, It's a kernel that can be written like that because of some invariance properties. That if you change phi into phi squared, this is different. This will be so it has an invariance. We are at a critical point, if you want. You see, if you can change phi into phi plus a constant, so we are dealing with a massless theory. So we are at a critical point. Correlation length is infinite. Okay. So we know that it has to be Gaussian. It has to be massless, so we can shift the phi, so it has to be a function of the difference between the phi. But now we can generate interaction between spins at arbitrary distances I and G on the lattice. Okay. Because of translation invariance, you can show that Kig is in fact a function of I minus G if I and G are the vectors on the lattice because of translation invariance. Okay? So, and then you can perform that up to some Kig, write that A of S of phi S, this is of course F I prime, is just a sum over Ig of Kig of S, phi I minus phi G squared. Well, you can compute this term. And it's a function of the distance, so let us write the strength between let us write what is Kig as a function of I minus G. I'm going just in one direction, but you can represent it in the space. So originally, you see, you had a Kig which was just non-zero for point at distance one. This is the distance between the points. Okay? And it was symmetric, let us say. This means that I just had this and this coupling with plus one and minus one with the distance between I minus G. So here I have I and here I have G equal I plus one and here I have G equal I minus one. So if you do the calculation here, you end up with an interaction between two points E and G with some distance L, okay? But you find that it is a function like that. For large S, it becomes Kig of S becomes a function K of L that decays exponentially, in fact, I think, at L going to infinity. So you see. So we have now a non-trivial action involving couplings between the fields at large distances, but the farther they are, the smaller the interaction is. So we are still in a space of theory where we expect that this kind of calculation makes sense. Because if we go to larger distances, we can neglect the fine structure of the blocks. Okay? Yes? Well, I've yes?
How do you know when you go in the other direction what you're basically adding to these
things? How do you know? No. Here I have been doing what we have been doing in statistical mechanical course. I have integrated over blocks to get less degrees of freedom and then continuing. So I average over average over average over average. Okay? Okay. So this is a case where it's a nice exercise to make the calculation and to check that indeed, so you see, those Kig are the renormalized coupling, the constant of your, that defines your Hamiltonian. You start with a theory with just one coupling, the strength of the interaction, let's say kappa 1, that is the strength of the interaction between two points, you end up with effective interaction between points at large distance, but still, basically, it's only what's happening in the vicinity of a point is important. And that's also the theory. The model we have is massless. So you see, the correlation length of the model is infinite, but the range of the interaction is finite. And we know very well that you may very well have a statistical model with an infinite correlation length, with starting from a microscopic model or microscopic action that has short range interaction. The example, prominent example, is the Ising model. You don't need to introduce large distance interaction between the spins in the Ising model in order to have to reach a critical point. You just have to fine tune the temperature. Okay? Well, it's been already too long, so I just gave you the idea of this Wilsonian renormalization group transformation, something that I think you have already seen in the statistical mechanics. So I'm rephrasing that in the language that I'm going to use. And remember just that this block spin transformation of renormalization group transformation first defines a flow in the space of couplings. They also defines a flow in the normalization of the fields phi, the variables on which we integrate. And under this transformation, the correlation function of the theory satisfies a simple law of transformation. If you know how the couplings kappa changes with the scale, once with the scale, then you can relate, you can compute the correlation function at large distances, for instance, to the correlation function of the model at small distances. Remember, here S, of course, is much, much larger than 1, because I start from a B that is 2 or 3, and I iterate. So here B is much larger than 1. So this is small distances, and this is large distances. See? And of course, what will be interesting is what happens if, starting from some kappa alpha here, we end in some specific point where things don't depend much on the kappa alpha. Namely, if here we reach some kind of what is called a fixed point, then we are in a good situation. Okay. So that's just a general picture. And tomorrow, I'm going to apply this to a specific calculation for the phi 4 theory, using, in fact, not from scratch, but using the tools that we have developed before this week, in particular, using the form of the effective action, which makes calculation very, very simple. And then we'll make the comparison both with perturbative renormalization group transformation. And in fact, I think you will also see the connection with what you have been doing in the statistical mechanics course. Okay, thank you. And sorry for being, I'm a bit too long. Longer every time. So you should raise your hand and say that you want a break.